Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman. Welcome to The Marvels of Science, a podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains from Groot and Gamora to Rocket and Star-Lord.
Who?
Speaking of the Guardians of the Galaxy, today's topic is another spacey one, asteroids. Here with me to talk about rocks and the space they fly through is Stephanie Deppa, our science expert today. Stephanie is a planetary astronomer who studied distant dwarf planets and other far-out objects for her PhD, and is now the astronomy content strategist for the Vera Rubin Observatory. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
And our color commentator is Lauren Wilson. Lauren is a facilitator and educator specializing in museum education and community engagement, and is setting the record for the shortest distance between me and a guest. Lauren's my neighbor and is recording from like 40 feet away. I'm pretty sure if I yell, you could hear it in her microphone. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Lauren.
Glad to be one floor above you.
We are here today to talk about asteroid belts, or is it asteroid fields? We'll see. In Guardians of the Galaxy 2, our heroes make a daring escape in their spaceship through a quantum asteroid field. Before we get into the science of space rocks, let's take a look at the quantum part. I checked in with Daniel Whiteson, the particle physicist and UC Irvine professor that I know from his podcast, Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe with Jorge Chom. Daniel was the guest on the 6th episode of Marvels of Science, The Incredible Shrinking Man, about quantum mechanics. And I asked him if a quantum asteroid field is a thing. Daniel? I guess that's a no, but check out his episode on Boltzmann brains for more details, because the answer is kind of mostly no. Asteroid fields in general, then, for us. Lauren, you haven't seen the scene that we're talking about, right?
Correct. I have not.
Well, it's no problem, because other than the whole blinking in and out of existence part, it's pretty similar to asteroid fields we've seen in other sci-fi. So if you could do us a favor and paint a picture of, because this is we're talking about a visual scene in an auditory medium. So if you could paint us a picture of what in a sci-fi movie, generic as you like, flying through an asteroid belt looks like.
Wow. Okay. I don't even know what movie I'm imagining right now. First, we're kind of a distance from it. We're not quite flying through it yet. And it's like a long stream, a belt-like. And I feel like there's an aura around it, like a blue kind of aura. And then there's little rocks, but they're probably not so little. But on the screen, they look small. And it's approaching it. Everyone's kind of freaking out because for whatever reason, they're like being sucked toward it, because I don't know how space works entirely. But I feel like they're like, no, we can't avoid it.
Like, couldn't possibly go above it or below it. Yeah,
correct. There's also a lot of noise, I think, happening. But from what I have been told by a partner who is really particular about base noise accuracy, we shouldn't hear anything when we're looking at things happening in space, regardless. So then I feel like they go through it, and then it's a lot of, you know, bumping around, and people are jostling, and you hear dings of the asteroids hitting the craft. And I feel like they usually make it through. That's a feeling I get, and something I'm recalling, but I don't know if it's entirely accurate.
Yeah, I don't know if I can think of a sci-fi movie where they didn't make it out. Although, actually, come to think of it, in this scene, they wind up getting beat up a lot by the bad guys chasing them. They're trying to lose them in the field is the thing. So they kind of do get beat up and have to crash land somewhere. But, you know, the bad guys blow up constantly, but they manage to dodge and weave and all that. So, yeah, thank you very much. That was wonderful. I think you have a career in Hollywood ahead of you, because that's basically how every single asteroid belt scene in a sci-fi movie goes. It gives the heroes a chance to show off their piloting. They're sort of dodging and weaving between the asteroids that are very close together, some large, some small. In the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, the second one, it gives Rocket and Peter a chance to have an argument about who's the better pilot. So it does serve the plot, but there's a problem with it, and we're going to get to it. But first, we need to define some terms. First up, Stephanie, what is an asteroid anyway?
So an asteroid is, well, one of these objects that lives out in the region of the asteroid belt, but it is something that has not quite formed into a planet. So it's smaller than a planet. There are a few even like dwarf planet sized objects in the asteroid belt. But what distinguishes asteroids from, say, other objects in the solar system is that they are very small. They are irregularly shaped, so they're not round. They look pretty lumpy and jagged. They typically don't have any water or what we call volatiles on them, so there's no ices or water or anything like that. That's all been sort of stripped away by the vastness of space and the sun and all of these fun things that happen out in space.
Who here hasn't been to space?
And they also are sort of collected in this region between Mars and Jupiter in the solar system.
All right. That steps right on the quiz I was about to give Lauren. So Lauren, you got saved. I was going to ask you where the asteroid belt was.
Something about Jupiter and Mars.
Picture the solar system as like a series of rings where each ring is the orbit of the planet, like a line drawn.
Yes.
And in between Mars and Jupiter, there's a gap, as there is between all of them, and it's filled with this asteroid belt.
Oh, okay.
Stephanie, is this a tautology, basically? Are all asteroids in the asteroid belt? Like, if one gets kicked out, do we call it something different?
They're not necessarily in the asteroid belts, but yeah.
Okay, so it could be a small rocky object somewhere else, like let's say floating between Venus and Mercury or whatever. If there were one, we'd still refer to it as an asteroid.
Yeah. Yeah, so most asteroids are found in this region of the asteroid belt. But there are some that sort of leak in toward the inner solar system where Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars are. Those are typically called something different just because they are dynamically different from the main asteroid belt, which just means that their orbits look different than the orbits of the things that are in the main asteroid belt. But they are still technically asteroids.
And in like junior high or whatever, it was made clear to me the difference between a meteor and a meteorite, that a meteorite has landed and a meteor is coming through the atmosphere. But what's the difference between an asteroid and a meteoroid? Or are these just casual terms without scientifically rigorous definitions?
Actually, usually an asteroid is different from a meteoroid primarily by size.
Oh.
So a meteoroid is typically much, much smaller than an asteroid. And they range from sort of like small grain size, almost like sand, to maybe a few feet across or a meter for our metric listeners. So asteroids typically much bigger, meteoroids much smaller.
Gotcha.
Is the difference just the size or is it also their makeup? I never even bothered to think about the difference between the two of them before. So now I'm interested.
Typically, meteoroids are very metallic. Asteroids can be metallic or they might not be. A meteoroid might have, say, a lot of iron in it, whereas asteroids might have some of that metallic material in their cores, or they might be too small to have ever undergone that process and might just be more like rocks rather than metal.
And last sort of definition question. Lauren, take your guess first. And it's important to note that I don't know the answer here either. What's the difference between an asteroid belt and an asteroid field?
If I had to guess, I would say the belt is the whole thing, the whole ring of them. And then the field is like a particular, like if an object is flying through a belt. So it's more about proximity.
I like it. Works for me.
I think I would agree with that definition. So I would call the belt the entire collection as a whole, whereas probably what you're used to seeing in sci-fi movies, an asteroid field, you're sort of locally in one area of the asteroid belt.
All right. I like it. Okay. So let's talk about the big problem with sci-fi asteroid belts, fields, whatever they are. This show doesn't usually do gotcha journalism or journalism of any sort, really. But when we see something wrong, we got to call it out. It's a lot more fun to celebrate the movies and to talk about the science they got right rather than all the things they get wrong and be nitpicky. But ever so often, it's fun. So, Lauren, what's your guess as to the major difference between the asteroid belt in our solar system and the asteroid belts we tend to see in sci-fi? What do you think is the big inaccuracy there?
Oh, I bet maybe the color and shape and size.
Color, shape, and size are, you think they're too big or too small in movies?
Well, going back to what I remember, something Stephanie said earlier, maybe they're too big because you talked about pieces of sand, or maybe that was about meteoroids. So never mind. I think maybe they're too big. I'm going to say too big. That's my final answer.
Stephanie, I'm guessing you did some TA work during your PhD. Whether that's true or not, would you please grade Lauren's answer?
You know, Lauren, I'm going to have to fail you on this one.
Oh,
I know. Actually, the sizes in the movies are, I think, pretty reasonable. Sizes of asteroids can actually vary by, like, from what we were saying meteoroids sort of go up to maybe meter across. Asteroids kind of take over after that. So they can be a meter to hundreds of kilometers across. Asteroids are actually very wide ranging in size. Now, the big inaccuracy with sci-fi movies is actually the density of objects that they're flying through.
Oh, come on. I would never have thought density.
Whole premise of the entire scene is all wrong.
How do I perceive density?
Lauren, I think Stephanie's not referring to the density of each individual object, but how many asteroids we see in one frame of...
Okay, well, now we know who's dense.
Hey!
All right, get your jokes out now.
Yeah, the number of objects that they fly through is all wrong. If you were to actually try to fly a spaceship or something through the asteroid belt, you wouldn't have to worry about hitting anything ever on your way through.
Oh, it's not like density when we talk about like cities. It's more rural.
Yeah. Yep. Asteroids are a rural area.
But I will say that the asteroid belt is one of the more dense regions of our solar system. So if that puts into context how empty the solar system actually is, like you can fly through the densest part of our solar system and not worry about hitting anything ever because it's so not dense.
According to Sandy Toksvig, host of British Bake Off, but more relevantly, QI, the Quizzy panel show, the average distance between any two objects in the asteroid belt is about 600,000 miles. Does that sound right, Stephanie? Or can
that
I get some publicity for the podcast for calling Sandy out and starting a Twitter flame war?
I know. I don't think I'm going to be the source of a social media war. I think that sounds about right. Yeah, you actually have to try really hard to hit something in the asteroid belt. If we want to launch a space mission, for example, to an asteroid in the asteroid belt, which we have done, there have been missions that have gone to the asteroid Ceres, which is the biggest object in the asteroid belt. We actually have to try pretty hard to hit it. Like we have to know precisely where the thing is so that we can send something right to it. Otherwise, we'll miss it. Like it's really hard to hit anything at all in the asteroid belt, even though it is the most dense region of the solar system.
Dave, you're probably getting to this. So why even make it a thing in a movie?
Oh, I think it's just easy drama.
For the drama.
Otherwise, space is boring. I guess there's no like environmental threat.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because if you look at shows like The Expanse, which is near future, trying to be as realistic as possible with a few fudges and one enormously major fudge, their space travel is almost entirely uneventful. They go somewhere, they accelerate for half of it, they turn around, they decelerate, they don't have artificial gravity or anything like that, and their travel itself is boring, and that's where none of the drama comes from. They skip it. Sometimes, like, one scene to the next is 2 months later because it took them 2 months to travel somewhere. But if you're making yourself a blockbuster movie and you want some drama and you're trying to get your good guys to run away from your bad guys, it'd be nice if they had something to dip and dodge and weave around. So the asteroid field. I often try to think of like excuses for the bad science in the movie. It's just more fun. And if you had a planet that was broken apart rather than didn't form in the first place, and that gives you like a local small asteroid field, maybe you'd have a rocky area that's pretty densely packed compared to, let's say, an asteroid belt. So when I see one in movies, I tend to think, oh, I bet there was some cataclysmic event that just happened like yesterday.
I like that explanation better than trying to say that they're going through something like the asteroid belt. I'm going to choose to believe that in future sci-fi movies from now on.
Great.
The asteroid field has its whole backstory, its own backstory that you never get to see, but they build it as a character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got two more areas of the solar system that have some similarities to the asteroid belt. Lauren, I'd like to give you the honor of renaming these areas.
Oh, you're using your made-up names.
So I'm going to describe them for you, and then you think of a name that you'd like to call them from now on, and we're going to go with that. Okay. One of them is a disk around the solar system, similar to the asteroid belt a little bit, but a lot more stretched out. It's also way farther out. It starts after Neptune's orbit, so it's way out there, which is around 30 astronomical units from the sun. An astronomical unit, an AU, is the distance between Earth and sun. So it starts 30 AU from the sun and goes to like 50. So would you please give us a name for this enormous ring of stuff out there? It's got to be culturally significant. It's got to represent the planet and our view of the solar system. This is a big ask.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. I'll do my best. I mean, I kind of like big ring of stuff. I mean, that's the most obvious. This is not a great name.
I think big ring of stuff is fine.
Really, 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 really. This is part of the name.
Oh, okay.
Really, 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 really Far Away, Big Ring of Death.
Ooh, well, see, the problem is wait till the next one. Stephanie.
It's even further.
Stephanie, you spent an awful long time studying this particular region. What do you call it?
This region of really, 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 sorry, I missed how many reallys.
Who knows?
Far out big ring of stuff is called the Kuiper Belt.
Oh, I've heard of that.
All right. And how is it different than the asteroid belt? Or is it just the same thing farther away? A repeat?
It's a very similar idea. But the primary way that it's different is that there's a lot more ice. So these objects, these small objects out in this region, which, you know, are sort of similar size to asteroids. There's stuff out there that's as big as stuff we see in the asteroid belt. That's as small as things we see in the asteroid belt. It's a very similar idea, but because it's so much farther away from the sun didn't have a chance to like boil off all of the ices and everything on these objects. So I like to call Kuiper Belt objects basically icy asteroids. So they have a lot of ices. That includes water ice, nitrogen ice, methane ice. These objects out beyond Neptune still have those. And so they're icy asteroids.
So in the asteroid belt, they're too close to have kept their ice if they had any in the first place. And it was boiled off. So I suppose if it were literally boiled off, we'd see clouds of vapor in the asteroid belt?
Yeah, I mean...
Or is this just a terminology thing?
It's more of a terminology thing. Okay. And also that process happened a very long time ago and over a very long period of time. So you wouldn't, like, it's not like it all sort of puffed up in a cloud. It gotcha. Happened over a very slow period of time by sort of human lifespans, I guess, relatively quickly in the timescale of the solar system. Basically, yeah. So there's basically a line, well, a sphere around the sun that we call it a line. So there's this ice line. And inside of the ice line, you don't find any ices because the sun's radiation and other things going on in outer space basically got rid of all of the exposed ices on anything inside of this ice line. But outside of the ice line, those ices weren't too close to the sun. So these objects were able to hold on to their ices.
I would assume the ice line is closer in than the Earth, but maybe you're referring to sort of atmosphere-less objects?
Yes. This really only applies to things without atmospheres. If you have an atmosphere, then things change a little bit because the atmosphere protects you from the sun's intense radiation and makes it harder for the sun to get rid of all of these ices that we want. So that's why the Earth still has water and methane and nitrogen and those kinds of things, is because the atmosphere and also our magnetic field help protect us from the intense radiation from the sun that would otherwise get rid of those things. It depends on exactly which molecules you're talking about. So nitrogen will have a different ice line location from methane, which will have a different one from water ice, but they all sort of fall around a similar region. So the ice line in the solar system currently is around 5 astronomical units, which is why none of the asteroids really have any ices on them anymore. But the ice line or snow line distance can actually evolve over the course of the solar system as sort of the nebula that everything formed from dissipates and as the sun is less active and lower temperature. But the current ice line, snow line, is around 5 astronomical units, which is about the orbit of Jupiter.
Gotcha.
So I just looked up and found out that Kuiper was a person, Gerard. And so clearly he just named it after himself. So I would like to rename it the Wilson Belt is my...
So he proposed the existence of it, and our technology wasn't good enough to discover it until about 40 years after. And so we didn't find the first Kuiper Belt object until the early 1990s, whereas he proposed the existence of this region of the solar system back in the 1950s.
So someone else named it. Gotcha.
Yes.
As my understanding, that it's considered quite gauche to name something after yourself.
Oh, yeah. You don't do that.
I first learned that from Daniel Whiteson, actually. We talked about that on the quantum physics episode. We mentioned the Higgs boson, and I asked, did Higgs name that after himself? And he said, not only did Higgs not name that after himself, he objects to it being called the Higgs boson. And whenever he refers to it, he uses all, I think it's 3 or 5 names that are attached to it.
Yeah, there's 3 names.
All right. Well, I won't call it the Wilson Belt anymore.
I mean, too late. That's what it's called now. So, but you're also not at the hook for naming something else. We have the Wilson Belt, or sometimes called Kuiper Belt, outside Neptune. This time, I'd like you to give us a name for the stuff that floats around in a sort of shell around the solar system. This one is thousands to hundreds of thousands of AU away from the sun. And surrounds us not like a ring in the flat disk, but more like a spherical shape. all around the solar system. So what would you call that? You discovered that yesterday and you have to publish today because the New York Times is knocking on the door, not a journal. You're just putting it in the newspaper. So go nuts. What are you calling this one?
I'm getting images of like a womb.
Oh.
I think those, you don't usually talk about wombs in space. I don't know. I'm getting this sort of like nurturing, enveloping, like womb-like vibe from it.
Look, this is going to get weird, all right?
I like it. That sounds crazy, but I'm going with it.
I should never be in charge of naming anything. God. I mean, it took us like 2 months to name our cat. So I don't think this is the amount of time you have. Space net.
The space net.
The space net. I like it. The space womb. Is that what you said?
Space womb. So space womb?
Yeah. That sounds dumb.
Well, with no offense intended to the Dutch language, the actual name isn't great either. Stephanie, what do planetary astronomers call it?
This sort of shell of, again, icy sort of asteroid-like bodies is what it's thought to be comprised of. We haven't actually observed this, but we think that there is a cloud of objects about 10,000 astronomical units away from the sun of these icy objects that's called the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T, Oort cloud.
So the space womb, not that bad. The Oort cloud, which always sounded so sci-fi to me.
It's still sci-fi because we haven't found it yet.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised to see it was theoretical. I had always thought that was observed. And then I realized that the distance that is and the kind of objects we're talking about, there'd be no way for us to observe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need some pretty good telescopes to be able to see it. We're not there yet.
So Stephanie, the Oort cloud, it's made up of similar objects and maybe even icier as they get out there. So is this where we think we might see like comets hanging out sometimes?
Yeah, comets in the solar system that we see are typically, there are a few different categories of comets. So you have Jupiter family comets, which sort of only go as far out as Jupiter and then swing back in. So they really don't go very far away from the sun. Then you have short period comets, which I think Jupiter family are technically a subset of those, but these are objects that, you know, might only go out to the orbit of Neptune or so. These are the short period comets. It doesn't take as long for them to go around the sun. And then long period comets are the ones that, you know, we see once and then we will never see them again because their orbits take so, so long to go around the sun.
Oh, so the famous ones that we know of, like Halley's Comet, for instance, that sounds like it'd definitely be a short period comet because 76 years, maybe, I think is what it is.
Yep.
That counts as a short period? Okay.
Yep. Yep. Halley's Comet is a short period comet.
And these long period comets are like tens of thousands of years or something.
Yep. We'll only ever see them once.
Oh, I wanted to ask you actually about the Kuiper Belt. What is it that you studied in the Kuiper Belt?
In my graduate studies, I used a project called the Dark Energy Survey that was actually not intended to be able to study solar system objects. That's not what it was designed for. But the way that the survey was operated meant that you could use it to look for solar system objects. So the project itself was designed to study faraway galaxies, but I was using it to look for new stuff in the Kuiper Belt. And we basically built that effort within the Dark Energy Survey from the ground up, effectively. My advisor, about 6 months before I joined him, was like, hey, I wonder if we can find solar system objects in this data. And so did sort of a proof of concept thing with a couple of undergraduates, found out that yes, you can actually find solar system objects with this big survey project that was designed to study galaxies, not the solar system. Then I started working with him and we basically found over 300 new objects in the Kuiper Belt that had never been seen by anybody else before.
Wow.
No way. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was super fun. And one of these objects was a dwarf planet candidate, which we didn't realize at the time. All we knew in the data was that it was really bright in our images. Well, comparatively speaking, it's not something that you would be able to see with your eyes. You need a big telescope like the one we were using. But comparatively, it was pretty bright in the images. And solar system objects, when you're looking for them in the telescope, you're looking for something that looks like it's moving against the background field of stars. So think of planets. Planets don't stay in the same position on the sky every night. They move on the sky over the course of a year. Same thing with asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects and that kind of stuff. So you're looking for something that's moving against the background field of stars. And by how much it moves, you can tell how far away that thing is. So the thing that we found was relatively bright in the image, but it was also moving really slowly. And so that meant that it was really far away. So a bright thing that's really far away is either pretty big and shiny, so it reflects a lot of light and that's why it's brighter, but still pretty big, or it's really dark and really big. So, I mean, not like planet sized or anything, but bigger than anything else we had discovered up to that point. And so we were able to get more data from the ALMA Observatory, which is a infrared radio observatory down in Chile. And we measured the size of this object and we found out that it is the size of about the state of Oregon in the US.
Whoa.
Or like a third to half the size of Pluto. So it's pretty big.
Yeah.
That was the coolest thing that we found. And it led to a lot of publicity and stuff, which was really fun. But that was like my first big project in grad school. And I was like, oh my God, this stuff is so cool.
That is wild.
So yeah, we found a dwarf planet candidate. And I got to coin the nickname of it, actually. When we were still studying it and trying to learn more about it, we kept calling it our distant dwarf planet candidate, which turns into a mouthful pretty quickly. So the issue is you can't directly measure the size of it. It's too far away. So no matter right. how good of a telescope you point at it, it's just going to look like a point source. You can't actually like measure the size across a disk. That's the reason for the candidate part. It's still technically a candidate. We won't know unless like we can send a spacecraft there, which come on NASA. But
what was your name?
So distant dwarf planet candidate started very quickly became a mouthful. I proposed the name Dee Dee for distant dwarf. And so then that's Aww. What we called it. And that's the reaction everyone gives.
You're good at naming things. Yeah.
So the official designation is 2014 UZ224.
Catchy. I think Dee Dee probably wins. Next up, we have a segment in the show called Technically. Lauren and I are going to keep quiet for 2 or 3 minutes as Stephanie gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Stephanie, you have the floor.
Okay, so we've been talking all this stuff about asteroid belts and Kuiper belts and all of that good stuff, but you might be wondering, well, how did these things form in the first place? And that's a very good question. The reason actually has to do not with the asteroid belt itself. It's in the region of the solar system where you could feasibly have a planet form, especially the asteroid belt. You might be wondering why it didn't form a planet. Well, the answer actually has to do with that big bully Jupiter that's right nearby. And so the reason that the asteroid belt never formed into a planet is actually because of gravitational effects from Jupiter. So over the course of millions and millions of years, as the planets were forming, as the solar system was sort of settling into its current state, the asteroid belt was probably trying to form into a planet. There's enough stuff there, or there used to be enough stuff there, at least at the beginning of the solar system, for something to have formed there. But through orbits of all of these objects over millions of years, getting too close to Jupiter, Jupiter gives a gravitational tug and pull on all of these objects. And it basically disrupts that collapsing process that planets have to go through when they start from pebbles and grow to asteroids and grow into sort of like the seeds of planets. Jupiter disrupts that collapsing process. And so that's why none of the things in the asteroid belt were ever able to sort of collect together enough to form into planets, because Jupiter's gravity disrupted that process. And so then if we go to the Kuiper belt, it's a similar sort of idea out there. There's less material out there because that far away from the sun, the original planetary disk that all of the material, all of the planets in the solar system formed from, got a lot thinner out there. It's sort of at the edge. And so there's not as much stuff there. But a similar sort of process happened out there with Neptune. So Neptune also did these gravitational tugs and pulls and sort of kept another smaller planet from forming way out in the Kuiper belt. And so that's why we have the Kuiper belt and the asteroid belts, because of those big bully gas giant planets.
That gets me thinking a lot about, I wonder, you know, if things were spaced just a little bit differently, if a couple initial conditions were just very slightly different, we could be in a system with 10 large planets or a binary star instead of Jupiter or all the different possibilities. We live in a pretty, I mean, thankfully, I suppose, boring solar system, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things had to go right, I guess, for us to even be here in the first place. So like Saturn is actually a big reason of why we're here, because Saturn actually helps stabilize the asteroid belt against Jupiter's influence.
Oh.
And so if Saturn wasn't there, we probably would have bombarded a lot more by asteroids. It's unclear whether the Earth would have made it as it is to today. And so next time you look up at Saturn in the sky, give it a wave as a thank you.
Thank you, Saturn. Lauren, close us out. What are your final Rocky thoughts?
Well, I had a similar pondering to you, Dave, after Stephanie's great segment there, but it was more of like, what would happen if just Jupiter went away? You know, I hadn't really given much thought to asteroids, probably beyond the Jetsons, I think. And the dog was named, wait, someone was named Asteroid.
The truth is, Astro reach for
Ritu. Oh boy. But anyway, I hadn't really given much thought to them, and even when watching them in movies, but they're really fascinating. You're like, yeah, of course they are. That's why I studied them / why I'm doing this podcast. So I just want to say thank you, actually, for letting me be a part of this, because I love things where I have an experience and I won't look at something in the same way again. This was really cool. Asteroids are cool. That's it. Asteroids are cool regardless of their temperature.
Every so often somebody gives me a great merch idea. Like if I had any merch for this show, I'm like, asteroids are cool regardless of their temperature is such a good on a coffee mug. That'd be so good.
I would buy that. One of my favorite things about studying these small bodies is people get so fascinated by and enthralled by the major planets, which they should because they're so interesting. But all of those planets started out as asteroids at one point. Right. Like the reason those planets exist is because a whole bunch of asteroids all collected together and conglomerated into something bigger. And so by understanding asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects and all of these small things in the solar system, we can, you know, start to understand the bigger parts of the solar system a bit better.
In the zoo world, you know, everyone wants to see the big animals or like the big cats. Mm. Like that's what they're all fascinated by. And they are referred to as charismatic megafauna, which I just thought was the greatest name. So we could do charismatic mega planets, that attraction to those big objects. But you're right. It's like, you think about like ants and like little microbes that do all of this really hard work that keep everything together.
Nice. That's good. Appreciate the little guy. That's the lesson from the episode. I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Stephanie Deppa and Lauren Wilson, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers there's an episode 20. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Lauren Wilson and Stephanie Deppa. Their good humor and willingness to explore this topic in such a fun way means a lot to me. I'm going to ask you a favor, share this episode with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks, to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. If you want to go nuts, support the podcast directly at patreon.com/marvelsofscience. MCU audio clips were taken from Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, Avengers Infinity War, Avengers Endgame, Ant-Man, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Captain Marvel, and Thus Spake Zarathustra in an episode of the Jetsons, and all used entirely without permission. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience. And now find me on Twitter at @marvelsoscience. Thanks for listening.